Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You've never done that. Mommy made me mash my M&Ms. Is that an American warm-up?
That's an American
jingle.
Yeah, you guys love M&Ms.
That's...
We'd be like, mother made me press my Smarties. Like, that would be ours.
But they're all...
Will somebody get us another drink?
Welcome to Jim and Tomic's Musical Theatre Happy Hour. I'm Jimmy.
And I'm Tommy. And this is the only musical theatre podcast with cloudy saisons.
And conductor's batons. Here, we take apart your favourite shows, muddle them together with a shot of buffoonery, and pour you a refreshing glass of musical theatre conversation. Tommy, what are you drinking today?
Well, I think it's Perrier, but it might be Canada Dry. I'm not sure. Did you like that one?
I did. I did a point, everyone. I realize audio medium. I did a point.
I did that. I started to panic while you were talking and was like trying to run through, and I was amazed I landed on one that quickly in my brain.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
I would have probably just done Flamboyant Cocktail. I would just like sold out. Yeah.
Why? Sold out. Why are we drinking these things? I'll tell you. I have a question.
Yeah. Yes, you do. Nobody knows, though, because nobody got this.
No one got this. I was so pleased
with
this.
We gave
question.
Them a whole month. We were waiting. We were like, we're not going to do the podcast until somebody gets it right.
Can you imagine if that was the secret sauce behind
it? Yeah, exactly. That was the reason.
Last episode's question. Both Stephen Sondheim and Jerry Herman have worked on partial musical adaptations of the source material for this musical. What show?
That show is... La Cage aux Folles.
We are what we are, and what we are is an illusion. How it feels, putting on heels, causing confusion. We face life, though it's sometimes sweet and sometimes bitter. Face life with a little guts and lots of glitter. Look under our frocks, girdles and jocks, proving we are what we are. We are. What we are, half a brassiere, half
you
a
may be dancing with the girl who needs a shave.
La Cage aux Folles.
You always say, I'm going to say La Cage throughout this entire thing because I feel like I never say it right.
What? Au fall?
Au fall.
La Cage aux Folles.
La Cage aux Folles.
Le Cachofol.
I think it's an SNL sketch where they're trying to teach some guy French, and it's like, repeat after me. Je, m'appelle, pelle, Claude. Je m'appelle Claude. Le bleu, 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 bleu. Have you not seen this?
What? Tommy.
Oh.
That's from fucking friends.
Ah, well, you know.
Get thee to a nunnery. Oh my God. Tommy.
Hey, friends, I had to reformat that part of my brain to make more room for Sondheim puns.
It is a significant amount of defragging that needs to get done there. Remember defragging?
Oh, God.
Those were the days. Anyway, like, I don't fall.
Yeah, so Stephen Sondheim wrote music for the movie The Birdcage, which is also based on, I think, officially the play, although we'll talk about it, the source.
I think The Birdcage is just like everything. I think it's just anything that existed before.
Also the movie and the musical, because it's been the most recent rewriting of the same plot.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, like there was definitely elements from the musical brought forth. Anyway, Le Cachofol, music by Mr. Jerry Herman.
We've done
all the Big Jerrys now. This is the last Big Jerry. Time to do the shit ones. no, that's not true. Some of them are very good. Anyway,
don't you down talk Mac and Mabel.
I know. I would never. and there's a book by Mr. Harvey Fierstein.
Yes, one of his earlier forays into playwriting and book writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is post Torch Song.
Yeah.
But I don't actually know what he did before that.
Yeah. I guess, has he just done Kinky Boots and Le Cage?
Kinky Boots and Newsies.
And there's one with a cake on it.
It Should Have Been You.
No.
But
it's like It Should Have Been You. Or maybe it has a taxi cab on it. Hold on.
On the Town. I watched On the Town again recently. I love that show.
A Catered Affair, which you've probably never heard of. It's not great.
Is that a musical?
It is. And for what it's worth, the album art is a staged wedding cake on top of a taxi bubble. So it is both a wedding cake and a taxi sign.
And a taxi.
Yeah.
Very good. Your knowledge of cover art.
Oh, he's done
knows
a bunch
no
of
bounds.
Stuff. He's at Legs Diamond. I don't know that one.
Nope. And I guess, you know, like Hairspray.
Right. Yeah. Oh, and he did do Newsies. You're right. Yep.
He did. We've done
that. Oh, and he wrote the teleplay for The Wiz Live. Okay.
Oh, yeah, so he did. We did that as well.
Welcome to Jim and Tomic. Read the Wikipedia article. Sorry, everybody.
Yeah, exactly. But this show is we don't read Wikipedia. We read books.
Music by Jerry Herman, book by Harvey Fierstein, based on the original play, which then became a movie, although the musical's not based on the movie, which is wild. It opened on Broadway in 1983.
Yeah, 80s. It won 6 Tony Awards that year, including the coveted Best Musical Prize, where it beat out everyone's top pick, Sunday in the Park with George. Yes, indeed. And then it ran for 4 whole years.
Yeah, played for a long time.
It was extremely successful.
It's been revived a bunch, 2004, 2008, and 2010. And then was later adapted into The Birdcage, which is not a musical, but is more of a movie with music in the kind of play with music ideal.
Yeah, exactly. So, Le Cage, I feel like Le Cage is reasonably well known.
I mean, perhaps, but we're also gay, so...
We're homosexuals. So let us tell you heterosexuals out there who will have no idea what we're talking about, I'm sure. the three heterosexual listeners that we probably have. So Le Cage, I'm going to give it a go because normally I give it to you.
Yeah, I love it.
Let's just see. Let's just give it a go.
I'm excited.
Le Cage au Fall sees Georges and Albin, or Albin, however French we're going to be here. Albin is a drag queen who works in Georges' nightclub, which is called Le Cajofol, which is in the French Riviera. Mm-hmm. And they are married and have a son together who's called Jean-Michel. And he is looking to wed this very right-wing conservative senator's daughter, mm-hmm. Oh no, he's not a senator because that's the film.
He's what a senator in the film. They just refer to him as a politician, and I don't know enough about French politics.
Nothing whatsoever. Who are the Dandon family? Mm-hmm. All these great French names. But he is the founder of the Tradition, Family, and Morality Party.
Yes.
So together they come up with a scheme so that the families can meet, whereby Georges will downplay the family's career, they'll completely change their life, and part of that means hiding the very flamboyant Albin.
Mm-hmm.
But Albin decides to mix everything up and come back and pretend to be Jean-Michel's mother. And hilarity ensues in a lovely farcical way.
You did such a great job.
It wasn't too bad. It wasn't too bad. Didn't give the ending away.
Well, the ending is the best.
The ending is the best. The That's the totally point, good. Isn't it?
I will say...
The ending is exactly what you would expect.
It's so good. And, like, I love Lacage, but the best version is Birdcage. The whole ending, one quarter of Birdcage, is some of the funniest cinema in the world. And of course, it like adapted from the original French film, which is also hilarious.
Yeah, exactly.
But
it's just got that really strong farce.
Yes.
Fun.
Yes, and it is
like really, really strong.
It does this show, you know, in all of its incarnations, does that thing that farces do, where it's almost impossible to see the comedic twist coming, but the moment it happens, it becomes so immediately obvious that you like kick yourself for not seeing it.
Yeah.
And like
it's like deeply satisfying.
It's so satisfying and so funny. You know, when Albin walks in, you know, mother's here. It's drop dead. Like it's just so perfect.
So, shall we dippity dip dip dive on in?
Hop on.
No, I said dive.
Oh. Sploosh.
I think that is the other one that we do. I think we say hop on and sploosh. God. And then I often say, oh my God, do you remember Holes? And then we get into a 3-minute conversation about Shia LaBeouf. Anyway.
Everything's ankle straps, marabou, Shalimar. It's worth sucking in my gut, girdling my ribs. Everything's ravishing and sensual and fabulous. When Albin is tucked away and Zaza is here.
So let's go right back to the beginning.
Yes.
The origins of love, the origins of this show. So it actually originally, it was picked up by the producer who was called Alan Carr.
Yes.
Who I find that very challenging because Alan Carr is a like TV talk show host comedian guy over here.
Yes,
who could easily be Albin. I don't know if he's ever made it across the pond.
No, but I see him on QI sometimes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that I just can't get that out of my, because also it wouldn't be weird for him to
weird.
Put on a production of Lacage.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
But different person. This Alan Carr produced, he did Grease, right? The film version?
Yeah, he did the film version of Grease. And I think this is his first foray into Broadway.
Yes.
I think it was his only foray into Broadway.
Yes.
So well done. Good track record. But yeah, so he originally had it all tied up with choreography by Tommy Toon, and a score by Maury Yes, and a book by J. Preston Allen, mm-hmm. who wrote The Prime of Mr. Jean Brodie, for the theatre, which is one of my absolute faves. So on paper, you're like, this will be good.
Mm-hmm.
But it was weirdly, they changed the setting to New Orleans.
Yeah, they changed, and they Americanized it and modernized it a bit, which, to be fair, is what The Birdcage did, I think, pretty successfully. Not New Orleans, but California, I think.
But also, they didn't call it Lacage aux Folles.
Right, fair.
They called it the Queen of Basin Street.
Yes. Weird, what? And, like, maybe it would have been on Basin Street. I don't know, like... I think The Birdcage is a better title for English speaking audiences than
For sure.
La Cage aux Folles. What is it? It's like the Cage of Mad Women, something like that.
Yes.
Which also I don't know is the best. Like, I get that it's the title of the nightclub, but the show's not about the nightclub.
No.
So it's a weird choice there anyway.
It sounds like just like, I guess from the original play, it's a farce. Madness, you know what I mean, like like fully like that.
Yeah, it's about you as know. About as descriptive as like all, you know, all the bedroom farces. What is it like? Don't
well,
dress for dinner.
Off.
Noises off. Like it's got that. Like who cares what the title is?
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. But yeah, and I found this comment quite interesting. This was in Arthur Lawrence's book.
Mm-hmm.
He said this that he got given the script. Because he was set to direct this version,
mm-hmm.
Got given the script, and the first stage direction that he read was, the decor is early faggot. and he just is like, and then I closed the book, and that was that. this never came to fruition, because when they got they got two executive producers on board, and that production team was promptly fired.
Yes.
And then there was some suing.
Yep.
And then we got the good guys.
Right. And now we got Herman and Feierstein.
Exactly. And it became the show that we know today.
Yeah. It is interesting. They were only able to secure rights to the original play to adapt mm-hmm. from and not the French film.
Mm-hmm.
Which is
because it was the film was the successful one, like that was the one that people knew.
Yes. And like, not that the original French play played for a very long time, mm-hmm. but the film was, you know, internationally popular. It's still like on the top 10 or top 15 list of foreign films in America pretty regularly.
Right.
But they couldn't get rights to the film, and it's so wild to me, like, because it's all, especially since it's basically the same story. Like, I wonder, I'm so curious who worked on the film that was the holdout that said no. Because clearly the team for the play said yes, right?
Yeah.
And a bunch of them worked on the film.
I do think it is weird because, like, I would imagine one of your main reasons for not giving rights is because you're like, well, this is intellectual property and I could use this at some point down the line if I want to make a musical adaptation.
Right.
But if someone's musically adapting the play,
right,
which is literally like, you know, 3 degrees away from your content, you're never gonna musically adapt the film.
Yeah.
So I did find it really weird why they would have held out on that one. And as well, like, the pedigree of that team was huge.
Yeah. It's so baffling. And so really what it ends up being, the movie adds in the twist that the actual mom, I can't remember her name.
Sybil
arrives at dinner as like a secondary farcical surprise. And because they didn't get the rights to do that, you know, the Christine Baranski couldn't show up.
Yes, Christine. Who I think was in Sybil.
That's a weird.
I think she was.
Crossword clue.
Do you remember Sybil?
No.
Did you never watch Sybil?
No.
With Sybil Shepherd?
No.
That was like when I came home from lunch in primary school.
Uh-huh.
That was on. That's and like, it was like that and like Suddenly Susan.
Okay.
The glory days.
The glory days of.
Yeah, it was. It was like Sybil, Suddenly Susan, Roseanne, and Golden Girls. Like, that is.
Huh.
They were making those children gay.
Yes, they were. They knew from a minute
they knew.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was a weird sidetrack. Anyway, so Christine Baranski couldn't be in in the musical. But in many ways, that was a good thing,
mm-hmm.
I think, because it meant that the story is more focused.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because actually, I think that's one of the weaker points of The Birdcage.
Okay, what do you mean?
I just think it's unnecessary.
Oh, I think it's so funny, though. I will say The Birdcage is less focused on the couple. We learn It's still certainly very clearly focused on them, but I don't think it ends up being quite as heartfelt. It is just more of a farce, whereas La Cage, the musical, does have a really delightful, you know, bittersweet underpinning of watching this gay couple's relationship go through this tumultuous time.
Yeah.
You know, gives us I Am What I Am, the Act One closer.
Exactly.
Which you don't get those moments in the straight movie. You know what I mean. Non-musical movie.
Yeah, definitely not a straight movie. So wait, do you think it would have been good if the mother was in the musical?
I mean, I can see why the mother ended up in the film, right? Because you want to do your, in the original French foreign language film, because everyone knows the play, and so you need one more twist.
Yeah.
To, you know, make fans, right? And I think it's a great twist because she's been a Chekhov's gun the entire time. And then we shoot Chekhov's gun. And we shoot it twice, which is a delightful, is such a farcical thing. You know, that's Noises Off at the very, very end when all three of them are the bank robbers and they're walking around. Right? Yeah. Like that's you know, French farce to a T. I think it's a fun moment. But certainly it takes away time spent in other stuff. Although do we really need the 22-minute Kaja full dance number in the middle of act one? Who knows?
Yes we do. But no, I don't know, just like it, in the film, and I know it's probably quite bad to keep going back to the birdcage because that isn't this, but like that's my, like the scene when they go, when Robin Williams goes and speaks to Christine Baranski and like they have their little menage and Akaz, like I hate, that's like my least favorite. Yeah. I just totally zone out because it's not really like, who is this woman?
Right.
She's a bitch, but she's actually not really a bitch. She's just a bit blah.
Yeah.
You don't really find out the reasons why she abandoned her child.
Yeah.
And then comes back and it's all fine, actually.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't know. It's just a bit like blah.
Yeah, that's totally fair.
And I just like that in the musical it is a lot more focused because there is a lot less to play with.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? When you're on a stage.
Yeah.
So I think it was of benefit to them that they couldn't do that and they could tell more of a story that I think they would want to tell.
Yeah.
Because I also think that if they did have Sybil in it, I think there would be the temptation to go a little bit more heteronormative.
Sure. Yeah.
With the storytelling.
Yeah, that's fair.
And the like, you know, you're still family too, kind of like mum. Just because you know that that's accessible.
Right.
And you know that people get that.
Right, yeah.
Whereas taking her out of the picture keeps them in the danger zone.
Yeah,
like, let's keep talking about this couple.
Yeah.
And, you know what I mean? Instead. So I think it's fine.
That's fair. I do think it is just fascinating, you know, musical theater lives in this world of almost always being an adaptation and coming off, like I was trying to think, like what else comes from, like, I guess Gentleman's Guide ended up in the same place where they got the rights to the play but not the movie or something like that. Like only in musical theater does this, maybe in musical theater and comic books do these kind of bizarre rights disputes of like, you can have some of the X-Men, but not all the X-Men, and we get Spider-Man every 3 years, and, you know.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah, only in summers, but right. High holidays, like.
It's such a bizarre, you know, the commodification of art, I think, is something I'm machinating about a lot. And this is part of it, too, is the negotiation of, like, whose intellectual property is this? And, like, associating, like, as you said, it's the same damn story, you
it's
know
really just the same.
So what are the
but
things,
then also, why was the birdcage the film allowed it,
right? And like, did they have higher, more powerful negotiators, or did, you know, the one holdout on the original movie die or something? Like,
yeah, exactly, like that. I just don't really get it. Like, it's
and for what for what it's worth, I've looked, if you know out there, please let us know. This is not like for not lack of not looking,
not to like a, yeah, exactly,
like You would think I'm interested in this. You'd think someone who had the connections could do the research and, you know, find it, but no one has posted anything about this.
For me, the surprise was because Alan Carr had made such a hit with Grease.
Yeah.
That you would trust, you know, I mean, you just feel like, oh, well, you could probably do anything you wanted.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And also Broadway at this point, and we'll talk about this in a little bit more, but like Broadway was starting to become the tourist trap that we know it
right
today.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even like the Broadway plays are nothing.
Right.
Like, you ain't going to make no money. Like, this is like, this in many ways was easily penned to be big regardless of the content.
Absolutely. Like, it's not a passion project by any means. It is,
yeah,
you know, a intended to be a moneymaker.
Yeah. So yeah, a bit odd. Yeah. What I do recommend, if you're interested in the origins of it and how it all started, is I talk about it a lot, but it's to read Arthur Lawrence's book, because he's so bitter. He's so bitter and sassy, and it's great. It's really fun to read. But no, he basically talks, he outlines the entire, you know, how it all started, because he was there from the start, and
right.
He was talking a lot about when they were writing it.
Mm-hmm.
It all started with I Am What I Am. That was the origin. That was all they really had, mm-hmm, at their first meeting. Jeremy was like, I have this song that I think would work great as an Act One closer,
mm-hmm,
but it wasn't like, you know. And what's happened before this is this. It was just, this song will be a really good
right
end of Act One. And so from that, because I think because Harvey Fierstein was still relatively green,
mm-hmm,
they kind of looked to Arthur Lawrence to be like, so what do we do? Like, work, like, dramaturg right this for us.
Yeah.
And so he was like, okay, well, why would he be singing this song?
Mm-hmm.
He's a performer, so it would make sense for him to be, you know, performing, and it would make sense for him to be doing it in drag.
Right.
And then he was like, okay, so he's had to just come off of a performance, because it wouldn't make sense for him to do it as a performance, because then it just becomes a number,
right,
as opposed to being a, like, a passionate,
right,
like, you know, I'm telling George this.
Yeah.
And then it all just kind of, you know, steamrolled from there.
Yeah.
But I do think that's quite funny that it just started with, and it makes sense that it started with that song, because yeah, that song is,
oh, it's the best song in the show.
Yeah.
I would say second to, or maybe a runner up is The Best of Times Is Now.
Really?
Oh, you don't like The Best of Times Is Now?
Well, I think let's hop on our segue.
I got him to do it.
I know, I had to do it once, didn't I? I'm feeling all sentimental because we're back, you know. That's the only time.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
La da 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 da. As we walked on the sand, I heard la da da da. I believe it was early September. Through the crash of the waves, I could tell that the words were romantic. Something about sharing, something about always. Though the years race along, I still think of our song on the sand. And I still try and search for the words I can barely remember. Though the time tumbles by, there is one thing that I am forever certain of. La da 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 da
because room.
I don't love it.
Really? I think
it's not. It ain't my fave.
It's such a Jerry Herman, you know. I get Jerry Herman. It's interesting to like look in and see, like, yeah, and we were trying to figure out how we were going to approach the writing of this thing, and like Jerry Herman has an Excel spreadsheet of musicals and like boxes for act one and boxes for act two, and you just write the name of the song in, and like this one has to be, you know, there's a kick line in this one, and this is the one between the, you know, B plot romantic duo at like
exactly, and this is the jaunty dum dum dum, you know what I mean, number, and this is the more legato,
right,
like
exactly, and then at the very end we do it all again one more time so we remind you of the songs, like,
yeah,
you know, and
like for me I don't know,
it's effective but it's not revolutionary.
Yeah, I think lyrically it's actually pretty good,
yeah,
but musically I think it's his weakest.
That's fair.
I mean, not like weakest overall, because I don't know all of his of his stuff, but out of like Dolly, Mame,
that's
Cash,
fair. I
Mac
mean
and Mabel,
yeah, it's no Harmonia Gardens, you know, Hello Dolly, it's no Walking Down the Stairs, Mame,
no,
you know,
and it's like It couldn't be. There's not really any scope for that, and it would be weird because it's quite a low scale show.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But also, if it was, I wouldn't be complaining.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
It is like, it is interesting to like, if we're talking, you know, the big three Hermans, which I would say is this, Hello Dolly, and Mame.
Yeah,
this is the only one without as much of a kind of. There's many fewer opportunities for a generic giant chorus in this one. Certainly you have the drag queens at the club, but there's no like 20 waiters and 50 townspeople.
No.
And
yeah,
you know,
you don't have like the population of the French Riviera as your,
exactly,
as your backing.
Like they all most definitely have names. You know, and
yes,
they kind of have to struggle to pull, you know, the group of nameless people in the restaurant who sing The Best of Times Is Now.
Right.
And it is, you know, I wonder if that's even some of the faults of the show, because Herman was trying to fill out his spreadsheet with a different brand of content. And like, I do, you know, yeah, I don't know. Because I think this show, I enjoy this show. It has some moments that are very weak, that are very, very, very weak.
Yeah, I think so. And it's one of those things, like, I'm not going to fight the fight of being like, this is bad.
No,
it's totally fine, and it's very enjoyable. And I think the book is really good.
And it's important. Like, there's a ton of great things for the show.
Right, absolutely. But I think, for me, the weakest part about it is Big Jez. Like, I don't... Yeah. You know, I mean, I know... Like, I Am What I Am is a triumph.
Yes.
Full stop.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
But everything else is fine.
It's fine.
Like, do you know what I mean?
You know,
and sometimes it's poor.
And like masculinity, which should be a song about like butter your toast like John Wayne, but they do that in a scene first and then have a, like, you know, or even the one that really gets to me is, what does he call it? Right before it's Mama and they're like, having this farcical round about like hiding the dishes.
Oh, the cocktail counterpoint.
The cocktail counterpoint, that one.
Fucking
It should be comedy gold, right?
Yeah.
It should be Motherhood, America, and a Hot Lunch for Orphans.
Right, yes.
We know he can do it. And that and Dolly is so good. Like, you get the point in the song. You don't even need to see what's happening on stage to understand it. And then it gets so much better when you see them like hiding under hat racks and tables and shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Cocktail Counterpoint is almost a nothing, right? I had to struggle to remember the name. And it ends in the most comedic turn of the whole damn show. But it's kind of like, here it is.
Right. And it just like, it's so obvious what it is.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, because I love counterpoint stuff, and I think when it's done well, it's like with them, like the way it is in Music Man, I think is masterful.
Gorgeous.
Like, it's absolutely masterful because you've got these really distinct songs that work
that you'd
perfectly
never
well on their own
to fold into each other.
And then suddenly you're like, oh, this I Am in Actual Heaven.
Right.
This is like, we're going to do weird phrasing and leave lots of gaps. And you're just like, you're making a, not to mention the fact it's called Cocktail Counterpoint.
Right.
You're like, doing some counterpoint there? You're going to wait until everyone comes in. And so you're just basically waiting for everyone to finish their lines.
Right.
And then you just get, because there's five as well, it's very Jekyll and Hyde. Well, you know what I mean? Where you're just getting this barrage of...
And it is such a, like, it's such a loud and brassy song. And, like, the comedy of that moment is the, like, extreme uncomfortability of everyone in that room.
Right.
And the song doesn't sound like that. The song doesn't sound like finger tapping, forced conversation, you know, whispers under the breath.
Because actually, because that's the thing, is it sounds like if you were doing this in like the real world, like the setting of the song, at that point, the conversation would be really jarred,
right?
Like stilted, lots of pauses, really awkward.
Yeah.
Like you could do something funny with that, but actually what it comes out is if they're all pals and they're all talking over each other.
Right, and it doesn't ring well. You know what I wonder? Do you think, knowing what we know about Jerry Herman and the Broadway landscape at the time, do you think Herman was trying to pull an artsy Weekend in the Country style round,
maybe,
because
it's
not his bag.
It's very uncharacteristic of him.
It's not like any other
song. To me,
that's
like that is like Jerry Herman experimentation. Do you know what I mean? I've never listened to like Dear World or whatever, so I don't know. Maybe that's full of it, and it's all great, but I doubt it. It doesn't work.
No.
That's an interesting point.
I wonder.
But no, there's no way Jerry Herman doesn't feel threatened. He doesn't care.
That's fair. But even
you know what I mean?
You know, a lot of the other songs in this, save for the title song, I Am What I Am, and its various things, like I don't really care for Song on the Sand. I think with Anne on My Arm and With You on, I think the With Anne on My Arm and With You and on My Arm, like Counterpoint, is a fun moment. Like that's a fun story moment,
right? I know, it's there's nothing that's like, oh, it's this song,
right?
Whereas like in every, well, I was going to say every other Jerry Herman score. And Hello, Dolly and Mae, there are so many standout moments where you're like, ah, yes, this is incredible. This is so fun. This is pure musical theater.
And even like the throwaway moments in, say, Mame, right? Like, a man in the moon is a lady. So memorable and important. And like...
Absolutely.
And could have been not a song, right?
Yeah.
But
And like, I feel like the Man in the Moon could easily fit in here somewhere.
I know.
And it would be one of the standout, do you know what I mean? It would then be one of the standout songs.
And you know, actually, knowing Herman, I'm surprised he didn't just...
just rewrite. Just
crib
rewrite.
It. Like, he's done that before.
Exactly.
You know, the Man of the Moon was the lady. Like, if we're going to rewrite Lacage, it would be a good, like, post-death of author.
Absolutely. Switch it in. Come on. With B. Arthur.
Yeah, exactly.
They would be a great revival cast. The all-female version. I'm ready for it. B. Arthur and Angie. I don't know. Like, I think like Zaza's numbers are good. They're just like fun and showy.
Yeah.
And if you've got a good Zaza, then they're going to be very enjoyable numbers. And like the lyric, I really commend the lyric, because I think the lyric in We Are What We Are is perfect that number.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think for Jerry Herman, quite risque.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean,
you know what I mean?
You know, I'm sure we'll continue to touch on it, but like, it sounds like there was a lot of discussion about how, I don't know, political they were going to get with this show.
Yeah.
And there were times in the writing process where it was going to be a little more overt or heavy-handed or very like, hey, gay rights. And they reeled that back, I think, to the success of the show, honestly. But, you know, I Am What I Am is about as political as it gets.
Oh, it's full gay.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It would fit very well in a drag bar today.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it became,
you know what I mean?
It became the gay anthem of its time. Still remains, I would wager.
So, props to him there, but... Everything else, you could just go. Dook, dook, dook,
yeah,
dook.
Exactly.
It's not where it's. You know, it's not like it's not a cast recording. I return to.
No.
You know, I mean, again and again, because it's like, oh, the beautiful Jerry Herman music, which is weird, Because it's Jerry Herman. Because
I do that with other stuff. Yeah, it is, you know, it is one of those shows where, like, you at this point, I think people would do it so that they can sing I Am What I Am and have, like, the buildup and the excuse and the plot around that thing.
Right, yeah.
Which speaks to the success of the song. It's just wild that that's as, you know, it's such an important tentpole to the whole show.
Totally.
Which I guess, you know, perhaps starting with it in the writing process maybe was a detriment.
Yeah, they peaked.
Yeah.
On day one.
Yeah. And then everything
and
was...
they kind of did. Like, there is nothing better than it.
Yeah.
And I feel like that shouldn't be the case. It shouldn't be that your first song that you ever write is the one you feel like you should be able to, as you get to know your content more.
Right.
You're like, oh, I'm going to write this incredible duet for George and Alvin. Like, yeah.
You find that. And, like, you know, there's fun wordplay and a little more mascara. Like, we're learning about Zaza there, but it's still not quite. I think a lot of the songs don't do a good job to define their characters. Like, I think one of the tough parts I have, like, Albin, is perhaps the most developed character in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone else is pretty dang flat. You know, they are plot machinations as opposed to
characters.
They're there to make the farce happen, which I guess is a farcical thing. But you can have big, bold characters in farces.
Of course you can, and it makes it all the better.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? It really, really does. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, fair enough.
Right.
But I think, I'm really intrigued by your point that you made about the counterpoint and him trying to be a bit crafty.
Yeah.
I find that really interesting.
I do wonder.
Because I don't know, because obviously he wouldn't have known... They wouldn't have known when they started writing it.
Right.
That they would have been up against Sunday. So you wouldn't have been like, I'm going to be up against Sondheim, so I need to make sure I do it. But the landscape.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, Sondheim was really staking his claim by this point. Yes. Like,
well, and we looked it up beforehand. Famously, when Herman won, I think it was the best musical Tony.
I think that was the one that he gave a speech. Yes.
And he made some real snarky, backhanded comment
that
was absolutely about Sunday in the Park with George and Stephen Sondheim.
Like, fully. He said, "This award forever shatters a myth about the musical theatre. There's been a rumour around for a couple of years that the simple, hummable show tune was no longer welcome on Broadway. Well, it's alive and well at the Palace."
Yeah. And
I think that's brilliant.
It's so wild. But, you know, the landscape of the time, and certainly Broadway was turning more intellectual, and this was the beginning of it. And so is this the tail end of the kind of Herman-esque era of these toe-tappers?
Of the toe-tapping hummable. And I find that one quite tricky to answer because we're very much entering the 80s now.
Yeah.
Where we're moving away from the experimental 70s.
Right.
And we're getting into the Lord Lloyd Webber,
yeah,
well, and his faction.
And I do wonder, and, like, you know, I don't want to discredit, like, we, you know, our history. Like, this Lacage was revolutionary in being a primary homosexual couple on stage. Like,
yeah,
in a
big Broadway show,
in a big Broadway show that you know, middle class working folk can attend and enjoy. Like, that's a big deal. Don't get me wrong. And, like, I think we've talked about this before, I wonder how things would have spun were it not for the AIDS epidemic, or were it not for this, like, mass devastation of the kind of theatrical talent in New York. And maybe we would have seen more, because, like, I don't think Phantom of the Opera and Cats were terribly stemming off this Sunday in the Park intellectualism.
No, definitely. But, like, I don't see Jerry Herman moving into that world. Do you know what I mean? I don't see him being like, do you know what? I'm really getting how to write complex musical theatre to tell a story.
Have you heard about this Argentinian dictator? Let's write a musical about...
Exactly. Like, take me back to my matchmakers, please.
Right.
Yeah, like, I don't know. But I do find it weird that he was saying that when, you know, literally around the corner was Cats.
Yeah.
Like, in my opinion, it's hummable.
Yeah.
I would tap my toe to Cats. There you go, humming away. But yeah, it was weird that that was the point he was making, because I don't think people in the 80s were saying Broadway's the place for intellectuals. Do you know what I mean? So, which makes me think that was purely just a slight at Stephen Sondheim.
It's so wild. One, it is wild knowing the plot of Sunday and that it is this kind of meta commentary on art itself that, like...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, 20 years before... No, not 20 years before. Like, 13 years before, he'd said that exact same thing in Merrily We Roll Along.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And here's Jerry Herman, one of his colleagues, one of his peers.
Right.
Coming and saying that to him.
Yeah.
You'd be rolling your eyes, but it's fine. He won the Pulitzer, so it's all good.
That's true. It is wild, and I guess I've never quite had this thought so concretely, but that we do, that musical theater is an art form that has, that is home to both of these things. That is home to this, like, deeply intellectual Sondheim-esque, you know, meta commentary on insert subject matter here.
Mm-hmm.
But also... sequins and spangles and drag and show tunes and let's sing the chorus again five more times so that you remember it and like slow down the tempo now, right? Like, and that they're not two separate art forms, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And it's like the audiences cross over.
Yeah. Well, and even like,
do you know what I mean?
As much as we slam some of the music in Lacage, this is certainly, I think, one of Herman's most intellectual pieces.
Yeah.
For as much as he says, you know, the toe tapping is alive and well on Broadway. But it's got some deep commentary going on.
It does. And like his lyric is, I would say, I'm not going to go as far as say it's one of his best lyrics, but. In a different way, because like I think with like Hello Dolly, he does it in a more sort of poetic way of like looking at sounds and consonants and the very musical, you know, that musical lyric.
A lot of the lyrics in Dolly, I feel the room swaying because the band's playing one of my old favorite songs from way back when, is nothing until the music gets with it, and then it's a delightful flowy piece where you can't disassociate, like I can't say those words without hearing the melody in my brain.
Exactly. But whereas here he's really getting into wordplay and rhyme, and you know, it's more cerebral, it's more intellectual in a different way. It's Basil in is that the right pronunciation? Basil
of
base.
Oh, like not the not,
like basic,
got it, not the pasta
but the wanky, you know. He loves Basil.
But yes,
and that's key.
Yeah,
yeah, but like I'm not saying that Hello Dolly is, but it's not. It's quite genius in many ways,
right?
But it's just different.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I don't know.
Yeah, certainly stretching himself more. It is
interesting.
The I think it's the published libretto, for this show, is the most prescriptive musical libretto I have ever seen. Like, every scene starts with a full-on ground plan, which I don't know if this is just a publishing thing of the time or if it's something specific to this libretto, but, like, I've got it right here. And, you know, at the beginning of Act 1, Scene 1, they show you, and this is cool, I'm glad they wrote this down, there's, like, a whole, I forget which set design book I was reading it in, but they very much wanted it to feel like a zoom-in of a movie.
Yes, because that's how the movie started.
Yeah.
And they couldn't, obviously, if they, that's a thing they could pinch because it's not copying the film.
Right.
It's stagecraft.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
They
but
do
you
that.
Like zoom into the club and then the club kind of parts. Is that in one of the hat books, maybe? Does Sondheim talk about that? I don't know. But whatever that anecdote is. But like, they write that down and then here's the ground plan for the next scene and here's the ground plan for the next scene. And I always find this wild, you know, I'm a tech director at heart.
And like, it always, I always get a little laugh whenever a published script says like, and then they exit left. Like, even to be that prescriptive is such a wild, like, of course, just say they exit. Like, who knows if they exit left or right, or, you know, out the 9 o'clock bomb because you're in the round.
Right.
Like, you don't need to be, because in every script it says like, you must do this exactly as written. And so how exact it is can define technically how specifically you're supposed to do it.
Right.
And it's wild that they would care that much, you know?
Totally, about those things in particular, you know what I mean? Because then it's, I don't know, I find that a bit odd because it removes the...
Yeah.
The fun.
And certainly, like, all the stage directions are super specific, and I have no doubt that's Lawrence. Like, here's the choreography, do it like I said.
Absolutely. And I think, because if you think of, I would say the only time that I've seen a really, really prescriptive musical theatre script is like Fiddler West Side, where it's what's it called,
Robbins,
come on. Jerome Robbins, when it's him, you know, being like, I'm the best and this needs to be like this, where it's physically licensed, you know what I mean? Whereas I think being like, this is the set that you must use, that's weird.
Well,
like,
it's such a, I mean, speaking of my intellectual property mullings over, like, there's huge discussion in educational theater world about how it's a quote-unquote bad thing to explicitly copy a set design, to like do it just like it was on Broadway, but then you also see on the other side, build it exactly like this, it looks like this, do it. And we don't license out the rights to set design.
You know,
in the same way we don't license choreography, and much to the chagrin of a lot of litigation.
Right.
Like, it's, you know, people, this is, it's built on a bunch of like falsified assumptions. Like, you know, only you license it so that I can make money, but don't copy it for free. And if there's not a structure for you to pay me to do it my way, don't do it my way.
Yeah.
It's such a fascinating, you know, that we try to put bounds around this. I don't know, maybe I'm slowly turning into a socialist or something and throwing down the constructs of capitalism. Maybe that's what it is.
In this day and age? How revolutionary. How gauche. Yeah. Weird. Silly.
Yeah. Very bizarre.
Unnecessary.
Yeah, but if you can get your hands on the published version of the Lacage libretto, it's a fascinating stage direction read.
Yeah, I love stage, because I love in like the Tennessee Williams books, like reading the like pages upon pages of, you know, how the way that the sun is refracting through the windows and stuff like that.
I've quoted it before, but it's in Glass Menagerie. It's as if the candles on the holy altar of Laura's face have been snuffed out.
Yeah,
what a ridiculous sentence. How do you?
I love that shit.
How do you act that?
That's what makes a play script readable, though, because you're like, oh, stunning.
Sure, yeah.
You know? So maybe that's what they were doing. Where they were like, this is some really incredible stuff.
Exit down, stage left. Sit on stool.
Yeah, deeply emotional, really. I've just wept.
I am what I am. I am my own special creation. So come take a look, give me the hook or the ovation. It's my world that I want to have a little pride in. My world, and it's not a place I have to hide in. Life's not worth a damn to till you can say, hey, well, I am what I am. I am what I am. I don't want praise. I don't want pity. I bang my own drum. Some think it's noise. I think it's pretty. And so what if I love each feather and each spangle? Why not try to see things from a different angle? Your life is a sham till you can shout out loud, I am what I am. I am.
So hey, let's talk about being gay.
This show's so gay.
Gay. Did you talk about this in your gay documentary?
I did, because I declare Jerry Herman as a diva creator, and that his diva is Zaza, and how that kind of it kind of puts a cap on an era of diva discussion in musical theater.
But that's interesting you say, because how many years later? Not many years later. Mm-hmm. Like 10 years later. But 10 years later, we got Kiss of the Spider Woman, which is a show about diva worship.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But I think at that point, it starts to recognize itself. Whereas, like, Hello Dolly in its plot is not a show as... Well, here's a sentence I was going to say. Is not a show that is as much about worshiping a woman. But there's a whole... damn song where they're like, you're back, we love you, let's dance.
Yeah, true. Because right? I was actually kind of with you, but more in just the sense of
that's not
who she was.
It's not the point of the show, whereas in Kiss of the Spider Woman, it's the point of
that is the point.
It's a huge plot point. She is this, you know, scary but worshipable person. And like there is this, and so the point I make, which I think I took from the book about gay musical theater that I want to name in this moment.
I don't think I've got that one.
Something for the Boys.
Something for the
John
Boys.
M.
I don't
Klum.
Have that one.
Great Clume, maybe. Delightful book. John talks about this in the book, that like their musical theater ends up with this sense of diva worship and then theorizes that it does have to have something to do with the gender bending desire of queer folk, which certainly is a problematic statement, but
right.
Go
but
with
yes,
me for a second.
Yes, yes.
And so instead of someone fully existing their flamboyant life on stage, you read in Dolly or Mame or whoever. And then to then see it come full circle in a queer musical where the center plot point is the discussion of the inner femininity of Albin is delightful, is just wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting, like, because this is a all gay creative team as well.
Yeah.
Like it kind of shows.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And especially just at like the time as well. I think there's so many stars were aligning for this to be created
and
for this to work as well.
I wonder what you think. Oh, did I lose it? I was looking up reviews and like, you know, screw critics, especially this one. John Simon was a critic for New York Mag, maybe. And is terrible. Like, it was just terrible, would make like disparaging comments about people's weight and like was let go for just kind of being an all-around shitty person. Gave Kajaful a terrible review. And one of his points is that it's an oversimplification of homosexuality. That it becomes kind of fluffy and frou-frou and makes it really easy to, you know, sympathize with this couple because it is painted with, you know, pink lenses. Like, and I mean, he says, you know, but here it's worse. Kaj plays right into the hands of homophobes. No, quote, right-minded anti-homosexual, and which two-bit fag-baiter doesn't consider himself right-minded, would identify him or herself with the heterosexual characters of this Kaj. Crude, stupid, unprepossessing, or in this case of the young lovers, smarmy and untalented. Yeah.
This is the 80s.
I know. However, the sanctimonious piety with which this show is being hailed in standing ovations, critical hosannas, bourgeoisie self-congratulation, and homosexual ecstasies, the first act curtain number, I Am What I Am, Albin's defiant self-assertion as drag queen and surrogate mother to the young Jean-Michel is being touted as the new gay anthem, forces one to take it more seriously. I fully expect straight couples to wear the ticket stubs of Kaj as goody-goody conduct medals on their chests and take that I Am What I Am. It's fair enough. It is a fair enough show tone, cleverly integrated with the plastic and blah, 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 blah. Like, man, oh, man. And, you know, like, this guy sucks.
Hate reviews.
And an interesting point.
It is an interesting point. It is. The thing is like, there's like almost like three in my head. There's like three kind of time periods of thought about queer identity.
Yeah.
At that time in the '80s, where there was nothing.
Right.
You know what I mean? This was the first.
We're still
gay Broadway musical.
Firmly in the closet.
Yeah. Of course, it was wonderful because it was something.
Right.
Right. And then we got into, like, the late 90s, 2000s, mm-hmm. where gay rights were becoming more of a realistic, you know, idea. And then suddenly there was a lot of pushback against stereotypical gay portrayal.
Right, exactly.
Right? And then I would say now we're back in the world of, like, embracing the femme.
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And we're like, actually, Albin is a really well-rounded, identifiable character who completely would exist. And because it was funny, because I was like reading about it, I read an essay on it from, I think it was like 2004. Mm-hmm. The most recent revival hadn't happened yet.
Okay.
And they were basically talking about it being really broad.
Sure.
And, you know, I mean, like, you know, mildly offensive, I Am What I Am lyrically is so powerful, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I would have been there mm-hmm. in 2004.
Yes.
Like, I would have agreed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that was the time of, like, no, we're more than that. We are humans. We are, you know what I mean?
And now, we are in a more, you know, doing no small part to, like, RuPaul. You know, save for the fracking. Oh, can't say. Ooh. like
visual joke.
Yeah.
Last call.
Drag acceptance, and you know the we can talk around gender identity and sexuality much more lyrically now, I think.
Yeah.
Than even in, you know, the 2010s.
100%. Like to me, this is like a 3 year ago thing. Like
right.
It still feels very fresh.
I would love to see one more revival where we get to see the full breadth of gender identity, or, you know, even like cis gay representation, as opposed to the kind of, like, you know, one of them wears the pants in the family, and you know, and everyone else is boas and lisps and wrists and you know, and like, I think it would make the show a little difficult because it does play on a lot of that in kind of an old school entertainment way for the comedy.
Yep. Yep.
But it'd be a good challenge.
It would, but also it's weird because, like, those jokes, and it's not, it's because it's not done at the expense of anyone.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, Albin is still the hero or heroine of the show.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So he ends up on top.
Right.
At the end. So it's not been like the joke's been at his expense.
Right.
He isn't like the classic queer character who is just, you know, the camp like mess who giggles around.
I will
and
say,
and actually it's George who's the more stand up, you know.
I will say the character Jacob, the butler maid,
yes,
is perhaps the most problematic in.
We're going in broad strokes with the good old Jacob.
Yes,
yeah, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And don't get me wrong, very funny. And
it is very funny. Like, yes.
I've met Jacobs before, like,
and I'm meeting more and more Jacobs nowadays.
Right, exactly. So I don't want to say, like, you know, part and parcel, this is fully offensive, but it is a, you know, there's a tightrope to walk there.
I think that's the thing, is you need to go back to then authorial intent.
Yes, and
are you writing that
to,
you know, play up, or are you writing it because you know? Jake, you know what I mean? You're like, oh yeah, is he this fleshed out character?
Yeah.
No, he's not.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. But he serves as, it's a farce, you know, like.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And nothing that he says is so offensive.
Right.
That he is like the butt of the joke because you're laughing at him.
Yeah.
Because he's like a gay idiot.
Well, I mean, he does like blow up a chicken and walk on stage covered in.
But not because he's gay.
Mm, fair.
Do you know, that's just because he is like the bumbling butler.
Yeah, that's fair.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But the flamboyant, witty kind of repartee that he has,
right,
is actually just funny.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that's, I think that's where the but I still think it is. We're talking very lovely broad strokes there.
Yeah, like, I don't think we wouldn't see this musical created in this way if we started today.
No, it'd be a very, very different. And I think the thing is like, actually, if this was written today, mm-hmm. it could be a really good piece.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It could be a really good, but I also think it would just be unnecessary.
Yeah, we don't need any more like cis gay representation these days.
We really don't need more like drag queens.
No.
Like, and people like embracing that, right. Like,
yeah, especially where like gay is the plot point, you know, like, and where this one is very much like, it's a discussion of found family, gay marriage, you know, it is interesting to me in rewatching and rereading. And I think this is a good sign, like how, I think they only make it a joke once. I think Albin says, like, you knew my parents would never accept me for who I am, a performer. Or, like, in show business, it's something like that.
Uh-huh. And yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
That's maybe about the only time they really, you know, and then the not senator, whatever his name is, the dad,
mm-hmm.
you know, says some stuff about, like, you can't accept their lifestyles for who they are. But they don't drop the word gay a lot or at all. They don't drop the word homosexual, save for maybe two or three times. Mm-hmm. Which I think is a good hashtag good thing for gay representation. Because I think, like, it, you know, I don't say the word gay every day.
Yeah, without making it like the gay show.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
It's not.
Yeah.
It's not that.
I will say, and I might show my hand. How do you feel about Kelsey Grammer being in a recent revival?
Do you know what? It's not that recent now.
That's true.
That's the thing. Like, and it's because back then I wouldn't have batted an eye and be like, oh, great casting.
Yeah.
Nowadays, if it was happening, you can do better.
Well, so perhaps I'm assuming some things that you know about American politics. Kelsey Grammer is like a tried and true Trump supporter. Kelsey Grammer
I didn't know that.
Is like right wing. Perhaps
interesting.
The only exception to the like Republican agenda that Kelsey Grammer disagrees with is he's for gay marriage, which. It's probably the only reason he was okay doing this show.
Right.
But it's such an interesting, you know.
I didn't know that. That's
set
really
aside straight performers playing gay roles, which I think we still have a problem with nowadays.
Yeah.
Cough, cough, James Corden, cough, cough.
Right.
But like, especially someone as unaccepting as that.
Yeah.
In this anthem of a thing as clearly stunt casting, right? I'm going to go see Frasier in that gay play. Like,
yeah, exactly. Well, I think because it was... I'm trying to think who... Did Chris Sieber replace him or did he replace...
That is a good question.
Yeah, he did. He did. Chris Sieber. So Chris Sieber replaced it. And like, that's perfect casting.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's great. Because actually, in what is quite Awkward Turtle, it was Jeffrey Tambor who first replaced Kelsey Grammer.
Huh. Interesting.
Which nowadays, in the cold light of day,
would also be kind of problematic. Yeah.
That's extremely problematic.
Yeah.
And then they settled on Chris Sieber. And I think Chris Sieber, he was on with Harvey.
Okay.
When Harvey took over from Douglas Hodge.
Yeah.
And
that must have been delightful.
Right. That's a wonderful pairing. I love that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think. But then again, in 2010, that wasn't the fight.
Right. We weren't worried about casting gay actors in gay roles.
Yeah, because what a novel concept that would be.
He would have gotten pushback about saying, like, well, can gay actors never play straight roles? And it's like,
right,
no,
exactly.
That's not what we're saying.
No. But yeah, it's... I don't know. I want to have a bit of a conversation about, like, the... in more of like Lacage as a story, in this idea of like the performing gender and performing drag,
because
I think this is something that we're starting to see a bit more of in terms of a nuanced discussion about it.
Sure.
Because, you know, obviously most of the chat of this is, or like the most of the naysayers of this would say that it's completely heteronormative.
Sure.
It's just that they're two guys.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Because they literally call him the mother.
Right, exactly.
The wife.
Yeah.
And he plays... and the comedy comes from the fact that, but he is a man.
Right.
And obviously there, you start to get into like some difficult territory when it comes to gender.
Yeah.
Because actually... You know, is Albin cis?
Right. You know, is Albin some kind of queer? And of its time, we didn't have as much of a
this kind of parlance
to talk around these things.
Yeah,
yeah.
But exactly.
It is interesting because, like, you know, we both Hive Mind put this in our notes about like drag and performance, and this is a musical where drag is drag as opposed to like a joke. Like you run through, there's plenty of other drag, you know, whether it's the mom in Hairspray or Mary Sunshine in Chicago, or even like Trunchbull and Matilda. And like those are, I think, frustrating performances to talk about given a modern sensibility. Like Trunchbull in Matilda is kind of just like a mean sexist joke. I think there's a reading that way. And I will say...
Yeah, no, there is. There is. And do you know why? It's because Pam Ferris did such a good job in the film.
Yep. And, like, it is certainly informed from a different edge. Like, certainly informed, I think, from the, you know, grand British tradition of panto.
Right.
Which is different. Maybe. Yeah. Or have we been turning a blind eye to some of the, you know, sexism of... cis gay males performing in drag, which I think we have, honestly.
Yeah. I think that's the thing. I think there is a really, especially because in the drag world, there's such a contentious conversation around bio queens,
right?
And their legitimacy. You know, what I mean, that like it's not even like, you know, how good are they? How do they mix? It's like, can they exist? We're still having that conversation.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is that classic kind of gay gatekeeping
exactly
that we like to do as cis gay men. But yeah, like I've put down here two examples that I think kind of fit into it in different ways. One of them being Hedwig, which is a really interesting part of that conversation because Hedwig is a drag queen who is trans.
Right. Yeah, Hedwig is kind of that conversation. yeah. at least from a plot point.
And is done in, I would say, a really good, nuanced,
yeah.
intelligent way.
I will say, I mean, you can unpack anything. Can you name a trans performer who has performed as Hedwig, right?
Comme ça, exactly, exactly. And so there, like, there's, again, another
yeah.
kind of conversation, another side to be had. What I think, the thing that I'm like, they could get this so right, mm-hmm. right, is... when they adapt to Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar, for the musical theater stage. Because that film, obviously when it was made, mm-hmm. You wouldn't have been able to have this conversation right. about gender. Yeah. Like, they were drag queens.
Right.
But they lived as women.
Right, exactly.
Right? And now, I'm like, you could recreate Tu Wong Fu,
yeah.
keeping every single thing pretty much the same,
yeah.
but they identify themselves as trans, mm-hmm. and you have that conversation
yeah.
In the small redneck town.
Right.
Right? And then it becomes this, like, wow,
yeah.
we've not had this before. Like, this is yeah. special.
I
and
do.
And you get trans actors playing the character. Like, I right. just, I see it in my head, and it's perfect.
I do wonder, the thing I'm about to say, I'm not saying is true, but is a potential future I could see. Like, I think there's a world where our culture turns to look upon drag performance how we look upon blackface these days.
Well, a lot of people make a similar argument.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Particularly a lot of females
yeah.
Make the argument, whether they're cis females or trans females, like right. that is a big discussion to be had, because the argument always comes back as like, well, it's performative gender, it's performing gender,
right?
And it's, you know, a discussion about that, but I'm like, is it always?
Yeah, and I think that's the problem, is like, sometimes it is. And for what it's worth, Lacage does it well in that Zaza's signature move is pulling off her wig at the end of the performance.
Right.
Which I get.
I know some history about that.
Yeah?
That was the law in France.
Oh, really?
Yes. So the drag performance, because drag was quite a mainstay in France.
Sure.
But kind of one of the deals that they had to do was to show that they weren't that it wasn't coercion.
Sure.
They would have to take off the wig to show... this is an illusion.
It's like dropping the asbestos curtain at intermission.
Right, yeah, exactly.
To prove you have a fire curtain. That's wild.
Exactly.
Interesting.
So that's a feature, do you know what I mean?
So it's just a historical feature. Because it feels like a choice,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, in when they wrote this, they could have not done that.
Yeah.
But, like, not all drag performance, I mean, I think most drag performance isn't, nuance is not the word of the day.
No.
Which is the point, and it's fine. But it's not like every episode of RuPaul's Drag Race starts with a historical unpacking of why drag exists.
Right.
Which perhaps it should. Like, if, and not that I think RuPaul's doing a great job anyway, but like, if our goal is to increase acceptance and understanding and education, mm-hmm. yeah, spend 20 minutes in the finale talking about the history of drag.
Yeah. And like an actual history of drag, not just like a, like,
yeah.
we love Cher.
No, like, give me a Ken Burns moment of, you know, slowly scrolling pictures of
right.
you know, old drag performers in New York.
But that's the thing, because, like, the you know, I mean, they're more than happy to keep dropping Paris is Burning and just, like, just saying, like, oh, right. well, you know, like, Paris is Burning. And it's like, right. yeah, but what do you mean by that? Like,
right. My mom doesn't know that when she watches RuPaul. Like,
right.
She doesn't put that together.
And I just feel like that is thrown around so much. It's like, yeah, well, Paris is Burning. Like, that's, like, the right. origin story of... I'm like, no, it's really not... Like, it's a really good snapshot into the ball culture in New York.
Yeah. Yeah.
And... but, like... all the kind of drag race culture has yeah. done is just kind of pick some key quotes from that and then run
right.
away, and it's not really acknowledging, like,
right.
Venus Extravaganza and the fact that she was yeah. murdered for being
right.
a trans woman. Like,
yeah.
that doesn't get talked about.
No. Yeah. It's such, you know, we're And I feel like Kaj falls into this a little bit too. Mm. Like, not being the best steward of how we got here.
Do you say steward?
Yeah. Do you say steward?
Steward.
That might actually be the right word. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me say that again.
Steward's a person's name.
Steward. Steward. Not being the best steward of how we got here.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess on the flip side of that, because like this is the other problem with all sorts of queer representation these days, is like not everything needs to be a bury your gaze, like beat the dead horse again right. and explain it.
Right. Yeah,
because so
we want to get to that stage, don't we, when it's not mentioned, right. but also we really want to be mentioned as represented right. historically and taught. It's endlessly difficult because it's a social issue.
Right.
So there will be, you know, it will be discussed ad infinitum. but I think, like, to give Le Cage its dues, you can't deny that it is a cornerstone.
Absolutely.
In terms of musical theatre history, like, it is one of these really important bricks in the wall. Because I wanted to get a really good idea of what did gay musical theatre look like at that time in the run-up. And I was just so surprised that I think In Trousers was before this.
Okay.
And then I think March of the Falsettos was after this.
Okay.
And then Falsetto Land and Falsettos was definitely right. after, because that was 92.
After. Right.
But I'm pretty sure was after. So like this is undoubtedly the first, you know what I mean? The first gay musical. Like you can't.
Right.
You can't.
Yeah. It's you. Yeah.
In terms of Broadway, yeah. And then, but after that, we had to wait until Kiss of the Spider Woman, which was 93, yeah. and then Rent was 96.
Yeah, and then what? Fun Home?
Maybe? No, I think we probably would have had more in between, but I can't think, because I didn't look after Rent. Because the thing is like, I feel like with Rent, that was kind of...
It kind of blows open the floodgates a bit
yeah,
more.
That was in many ways like... putting the bookmark on gay plus AIDS. Do you know what I mean? Like that was after, I feel like after Rent, it stopped being about, well, if you're talking about gay people, you need to talk about AIDS. Like
right.
that's, and then it just became about gay storytelling again. Which is obviously fair. But I found that just really interesting that it wasn't a floodgate. It wasn't a Le Cage exists, and now we can be gay in theater.
And even everything you mention, and certainly it's a sliding scale, but Le Cage has perhaps, like, name another non-tragic gay character in musical theater.
Yeah.
Certainly they're struggling over, you know, identity and problems related to being gay, but it's kind of a, you know, it's still, even it's a farce. Even at its core, it's a whatever problem, right? It's not a big deal, which is what farces should be. I think that's great, and it's fun, it's exciting to watch gay people struggle with whatever problems, as opposed to like I'm gonna die,
right? Exactly, I think in many ways, one of the reasons why Le Cage was so successful is because it was an antidote to literally what was happening outside the theater, what was happening. Inside that production team, I think it was only a few months in before one of the Cagels died of AIDS, one of the producers died of AIDS. Like, this was their reality, you know what I mean?
Right.
And I think it was probably a nice thing in a way to see like, oh no, this disease doesn't define us.
Right, we can still find some joy in the midst of a pandemic.
Right, exactly, exactly. There is still love, you know what I mean, and family.
Yeah, and we can celebrate that and celebrate the other problems that still exist with it.
Exactly, you know, exactly.
Without this, almost extraterrestrial feeling threat.
Right.
And, like, we can forget about it for 2 hours.
Absolutely. And I think that is something that it did and does really, really well, is provide that the opportunity.
Yeah.
So, you know, well done, Lekash.
Yeah. When it is, I would wonder, like, I'm trying to run through escapism musicals post Lekash that aren't, you know, based like Your Good Man Charlie Brown.
Well, I think, like, I think we're gonna get into a trap here of when we say this is the only that, and then there is, because there is loads, because, like, 50. You know, yeah. Drowsy, A Gentleman's sure. Guide,
yeah, fair,
Mystery of Edmund Drood, that was 3 years later,
yeah, that's fair, but for, I think you're right, for something that is so closely tied to gayness,
yes, exactly,
and to not talk about AIDS, yeah.
Gay escapism, different story,
yeah. There's not a lot of that. And I think there's gay escapism. I think I see a lot of contemporary criticism about that sort of thing too.
Yeah.
Like in the context of like Hallmark Christmas movies and, you know, stuff like that. Like, why can't we just have like a story where the people happen to be gay?
Yeah.
And this is, for its time, a story where the people happen to be gay, which perhaps is the positive spin on what you wagered as the negative argument against this show. That it is a story of straight people who just happen to be gay. And that's one of the nice things about it. It's a story of straight people and they just happen to be gay. And complications ensue. Right. But that's fine.
I think, I don't know, I can foresee that world of just happening to be gay. Mm-hmm. Or just happening, let's just broaden the curtain a little bit more. Yeah. Just happening to be queer. Like, I can see that world coming into creation, because like one thing I've been quite surprised at, certainly over here, like in terms of like Christmas adverts or just general just adverts at the moment.
Oh yeah, have you seen the Nintendo Switch Christmas ad where the two gay uncles buy the kid Mario Kart and they play online? It's so cute, and it's becoming
that point now where it's just like there was one ad that didn't have anyone who was, there was no heterosexuals. And I was like,
that's awesome.
This is delightful. And it wasn't like because it's Pride. It was just we're just advertising our product.
Wasn't there a big thing? I've only read the headline, but I read that a grocery store somewhere in the UK read like a very gay centric ad and people protested, and then like the next day the channel, all the grocery stores teamed up and aired gay ads.
No, I thought you were talking about something different, which I need to reference and show you because it is brilliant. Oh my god, I just remembered this. It wasn't gay. It was a family, a black family.
Oh.
And literally everyone was up in arms. They were like, you know, so much for white Christmas, so much for, you know, like, I'm never going to be shopping there. Why can't you just show me people like me on the television? Like, all of this. It is absurd. It's sickening. It's absolutely sickening because it was a freaking Christmas advert.
Oh.
It was a Christmas advert. Yeah, I mean, there might have been like a gay equivalent as well.
Sure.
But that was certainly one of them. And yeah, one of the big things going on was like, well, let's just, because they were all like, well, we're going to boycott Sainsbury's now. And people were like, well, let's just have all of the grocery stores have it, and then they'll just starve and they'll die. And it's great.
Yeah. But yeah, it is such a wild, you know, I do feel like, especially in America these days, like I get the fatigue around some of these social justice issues and like, you know, can't we just fucking be done with this? Can't we just like, just leave me alone?
Exactly.
But.
Well, I think it's weird that I spoke to you about this at the top of the show, but Schitt's Creek does a really good job of it.
Sure,
There's a really good storyline that you haven't gotten to yet. But it very much feels like, okay, it just happens to be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's the thing, it just happens to be.
Though the time travels by, there is one thing that I am forever certain of. I hear.
and I'm young.
That was La Cage aux Folles.
You may be dancing with a girl who needs a shave. I think added to my list of dream roles, I think playing Zaza would be a lot of fun.
I can see that for you. Who would you rather be, Zaza or B. Arthur? I can't remember her character's name.
B. Arthur?
Just in general. No.
Just in general.
B. Arthur and Mame. What is her character's
name? Oh, and Mame.
Dottie? What is her character's name?
Vera.
Vera.
I would much rather be Vera. I want to wake up in the bathtub and, someone has spilled alcohol on my dress.
But also, the answer is just you would rather be B. Arthur.
Just rather be B. Arthur. Have you watched any of the new Animaniacs? You totally should.
Is B. Arthur in it? Did they resurrect her? Well,
in the very first episode, they have a song about reboots because, of course, in the meta world of Animaniacs commenting on the entertainment industry. And one of the lyrics is, I think it's, would the Golden Girls be smarter if we resurrect B. Arthur?
That's a very good lyric.
Yeah, it's good. It's real good.
Well done. It's not 3D, is it?
No.
Great. By that, I meant CGI.
No, it is good old traditional vector animation. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah, real good.
Love it.
Hey, I got a quiz question for you.
Hit me.
On the 8th of April, 2010, NASA played a song from this musical as the wake-up call on the International Space Station.
I mean, general knowledge.
I love this
question. It's really good. It's one of my favorite questions in a while. Hey, if you would like to get in touch with us, you absolutely can and should. It's been a while, kids. Our show Twitter and Instagram is at Jim and Tomic. That is JimAndTomic. Or you can drop us an email on our website at jimandtomic.com.
And while you're there, you can check out our Patreon if you want to financially support the show. Thank you, of course, deeply, dearly, and truly to all of our patrons. We adore you wonderfully. Also, reviews on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you can leave reviews these days. I'm sure you can leave reviews on Spotify.
Why the hell not? Give it a go. And if not, write to Spotify. Tell them I want to leave a review for Jim
Tomic. Dear Mr. Spotify, I know this podcast. Will you give it 5 stars? XOXO Gossip Girl.
Yes, perfect. But hey, most of all, do you know what? Just tell your pals all about us, because that is the best way for us to get out there.
Absolutely. Hope everyone's doing all right these days. And hey, thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Cheers, Jimmy.
Cheers.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.
The bisexual woman with a spiralizer is a bisexual icon.